special report, The Watergate, The White House View. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News, Washington, reporting with my colleagues Hal Walker and Robert Pierpoint. Tonight, in a broadcast address and a written statement, President Nixon has spoken out on the Watergate affair. And it was, Hal Walker and Bob Pierpoint, a rather long-awaited speaking out by the president.
Well, we've had a long build-up to this, Neil. As a matter of fact, the president first started discussing Watergate over a year ago in a series of news conferences. He kept denying any White House involvement right straight down the line and through the election. And then until April of this year, about 8 or 9 months after the Watergate break-in, he finally announced that something had happened, and he wasn't sure what, and he was going to look into it very carefully. And then on the 30th of April, a couple of weeks later, he allowed John Ehrlichman and Bob Haldeman to resign and, in effect, fired John Dean, but still didn't really tell us quite what had happened. And then finally, I think on the 22nd of May, almost 11 months after the original break-in, the president conceded that there might have been a few mistakes made, but that, in fact, what was done, much of it had to be done for national security reasons.
And that concession, Bob, of course, was made not in person, but in a statement delivered by the president, a fairly lengthy statement, 7 points, starting from the fact that he had no prior knowledge of the Watergate operation, took no part in or was aware of any subsequent effort to cover up, at no time authorized executive clemency for any of the Watergate defendants, and did not know until the time of his own investigation of any effort to provide the Watergate defendants with funds, and at no time did he attempt or authorize others to implicate the CIA in the Watergate matter, and not until the time of his own investigation did he learn of the break-in of the office of Mr. Ellsberg's psychiatrist, and finally that he neither authorized nor encouraged any subordinates to engage in any illegal or improper tactics.
Since then, the White House has taken the position the president was maintaining his silence until the Senate Select Committee on Watergate finished the so-called Phase 1 of its inquiry. And I think we have to remind ourselves of what has happened since in that testimony. It centers around John Dean, the former counsel of the president, and the testimony he gave beginning on June 25th of this year. Dean testifying to several meetings with the president as early as September 15th of last year, when he said he got the impression the president was aware of a Watergate cover-up. This is a part of his testimony on that September 15th meeting.
As the president discussed the present status of the situation, I told him that all I've been able to do was to contain the case and assist in keeping it out of the White House. I also told him that there was a long way to go before this matter would end, and that I certainly could make no assurances that the day would not come when this matter would not start to unravel.
Dean said there were also meetings with the president, Bob Pierpoint, in February of this year and early March, in which Dean told the president he himself might be involved in some way in the cover-up, and in which they discussed the matter of support payments for the Watergate defendants.
Well, as a matter of fact, Neil, I think that the thread that runs all through what's happened in recent months is that John Dean, in the view of the president and the White House, that is, those who still work at the White House, is the villain of this piece, and that the president and, to some extent, John Ehrlichman and Bob Haldeman are the three primary victims, and that is a part of what he is saying in his speech tonight. He starts out in another direction. He, in fact, starts out by a rather strong accusation against the Watergate Committee. He says that it's become increasingly clear that the hearings themselves and some of the commentaries on them have tried to implicate the president personally in the illegal activities that took place, and he calls these false charges. And then he goes to some of the charges that Dean himself has made, and he starts out by a repeat of his May 22nd statement of denial.
On May 22nd, I stated in very specific terms, and I state again to every one of you listening tonight, these facts. I had no prior knowledge of the Watergate break-in. I neither took part in nor knew about any of the subsequent cover-up activities. I neither authorized nor encouraged subordinates to engage in illegal or improper campaign tactics. That was, and that is, the simple truth. In all of the millions of words of testimony, there is not the slightest suggestion that I had any knowledge of the planning for the Watergate break-in. As for the cover-up, my statement has been challenged by only one of the 35 witnesses who appeared. a witness who offered no evidence beyond his own impressions, and whose testimony has been contradicted by every other witness in a position to know the facts.
You know, it's interesting, gentlemen, for someone who has been wallowing, as they say, or mired in the Watergate matter for, lo, these many weeks, we've had extremely long statements by a number of the witnesses, John Dean taking 5 days to complete his testimony, even Patrick Gray delivering a 51-page statement. I must admit that as one who's listened to these lengthy statements, I was a little surprised to hear a defense coming in a few short pages, some 7 pages of testimony by the President of the United States.
And that was, of course, a very direct reference to John Dean the President was making there and his own denials of any knowledge of the cover-up. Mr. Nixon said his only desire throughout this whole thing was to get the fact out, and he instructed all the law enforcement agencies to find out everything and kept being assured that no one higher up was involved. And this, in his speech, was his only reference to the September 15th meeting with John Dean.
On September 15th, the day the seven were indicted, I met with John Dean, the White House counsel. He gave me no reason whatever to believe that any others were guilty. I assumed that the indictments of only the seven by the grand jury confirmed the reports he had been giving to that effect throughout the summer.
There you have a direct conflict between the president and John Dean, and that I think illustrates the point that once again the president and to some extent Haldeman and Ehrlichman are making Dean the villain of the entire operation.
Incidentally, Bob, the president did not mention any of the other meetings with John Dean that were referred to in the testimony by Dean in February or early March of this year.
I think that one thing that is worth pointing out, and this is a question raised by a lot of people, and the president did address himself to some extent to it tonight, and that is why, if everyone in the country who was reading the newspapers and listening on radio and watching on television could figure out that somebody in the White House must have been playing games at Watergate time and that somebody was doing something over there to try and cover up his tracks, how come the president couldn't figure this out? And he said tonight, very frankly, that he could read those reports in the papers. He just didn't believe them, which I have a feeling indicates a certain degree of prejudice on the part of the president against the media.
Well, he trusted the law enforcement agencies.
That's right. He was going to turn everything over to the agencies, and they were going to try to get the facts, as I think he mentioned tonight.
Far from trying to hide the facts, my effort throughout has been to discover the facts and to lay those facts before the appropriate law enforcement authorities so that justice could be done and the guilty dealt with. I relied on the best law enforcement agencies in the country to find and report the truth. I believed they had done so, just as they believed they had done so. Many have urged that in order to help prove the truth of what I have said, I should turn over to the special prosecutor and the Senate committee recordings of conversation that I held in my office or on my telephone. However, a much more important principle is involved in this question than what the tapes might prove about Watergate.
And there we are with that issue of the recordings of presidential conversations made, the White House has said, for posterity.
Of course, those tapes we never knew anything about, those very secret tapes, until Alexander Butterfield testified in that surprising testimony before the Watergate Committee itself. And I think the president's argument goes beyond the legal question of separation of power or executive privilege in keeping those tapes away from both Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox and away from the Senate Irvin Senate Committee investigating Watergate, both of whom have attempted to subpoena them from the White House. The president went farther in a sort of logical discussion of why he felt such tapes should never be made public, should never be forcefully taken out of the White House.
Persons talking with the president would never again be sure that recordings or notes of what they said would not suddenly be made public. No one would want to advance tentative ideas that might later seem unsound. No diplomat would want to speak candidly in those sensitive negotiations which could bring peace or avoid war. No senator or congressman would want to talk frankly about the congressional horse trading that might get a vital bill passed. No one would want to speak bluntly about public figures here and abroad. That is why I shall continue to oppose efforts which would set a precedent that would cripple all future presidents by inhibiting conversations between them and those they look to for advice.
You know, it occurred to me while we were listening to the president tonight give that argument for not turning over the tapes that there was a certain illogic or inconsistency about what he'd said earlier. As I recall, when initially the knowledge of the tapes became public, he said these tapes were recorded for history. Well, if they were recorded for history, I assume that that means that historians and those who read history were going to listen to them, or at least they were going to read something from them. And now he's saying they've got to be absolutely confidential because nobody could talk to the president if they ever became public. I'm not quite sure how you reconcile those two arguments.
The thing that bothered me just slightly, gentlemen, was that in carrying forth this argument, he talks about the privilege here as between a priest and a penitent, as between a lawyer and a client, and other certain privileged conversations. And yet, in testimony before the committee, we have learned that his aide, H.R. Bob Haldeman, did in fact listen to at least one of those tapes and had a number of them in his possession at least overnight. So I'm not sure that that argument follows so clearly either.
At any rate, the president is still standing firm on his refusal to furnish those tapes. In his speech tonight, he did offer what you would say is something of an apology for what did happen in the Watergate case in 1972.
No political campaign ever justifies obstructing justice or harassing individuals or compromising those great agencies of government that should and must be above politics. To the extent that these things were done in the 1972 campaign, they were serious abuses, and I deplore them.
What led to those things? The president, in his May 22nd statement, said he might have helped set the climate for some of those activities. John Dean, in his testimony, said it was the White House paranoia about the anti-war movements and demonstrations and so forth. Mr. Nixon, tonight, went back a bit further. He said it was the people in the 1960s, those anti-war demonstrators, who were choosing which law to obey.
The notion that the end justifies the means proved contagious. Thus, it is not surprising, even though it is deplorable, that some persons in 1972 adopted the morality that they themselves had rightly condemned and committed acts that have no place in our political system.
This sounds a little like the president is saying that two wrongs make a right, but in fact, he came back rather strongly later on and said that those who have done this, that is, the guilty, must be punished, and he didn't seem to be sparing anyone on his staff or on the committee to reelect the president, or, in fact, among the Democrats, if they can be found to have engaged in this kind of thing.
We had expected this to be a kind of a... Some people had expected a kind of a hard-line speech by the president. Most of it was not. We heard two minds in the White House about the whole thing. But there was a bit of a challenge to the Senate Select Committee as the president neared the end of his speech.
After 12 weeks and 2 million words of televised testimony, we have reached a point at which a continued backward-looking obsession with Watergate is causing this nation to neglect matters of far greater importance to all of the American people.
Well, Neil, I'm sure I may take a little bit of issue with it. I think he closed at a fairly hard-nosed line as he talked about those who would attempt to exploit Watergate in order to keep us from doing what we were elected to do will not succeed. It sounded like a fairly almost a partisan challenge thrown out there to those who are going to continue to wallow in, as he said before, or be mired in the Watergate matter.
He seemed to be saying in one passage that the Watergate Committee, which still feels it has a good deal to look into, not only more of the Watergate phase one, or phase one and a half, as they're calling it now, but also the dirty tricks in campaign financing, he seemed to be saying it's time for the Select Committee to quit.
The time has come to turn Watergate over to the courts, where the questions of guilt or innocence belong. The time has come for the rest of us to get on with the urgent business of our nation.
Neil, I would say that tonight's speech by the president, of the three times that he has publicly discussed Watergate, this is probably the most soft in tone, the most a strong plea for understanding of the people. And basically, it seems to me that while there were plenty of questions that remained unanswered, it's the most convincing explanation we've heard from him yet.
And it's worth pointing out, I think, in the written statement, what that some of us were calling a white paper on the Watergate, Mr. Nixon says in his last paragraph, "I recognize that this statement does not answer many of the questions and contentions raised during the Watergate hearings. And I think that is true both of his broadcast address tonight and of the so-called white paper, which is actually shorter than the broadcast address."
One of the things about that white paper is the reference he does make to a telephone call that he had with L. Patrick Gray, then acting director of the FBI. We've had a number of, or at least two versions of that telephone call, one that Patrick Gray himself gives, in which he says that he called the president, or more accurately, the president returned his call, and at that point, Gray told him, "Mr. President, there are those around you who are attempting to mortally wound you by using the FBI and the CIA in some kind of a scheme." He didn't go into a great deal of detail. Vernon Walters, who was then deputy director of the CIA, said that there was much more detail in that conversation. The president passed it off simply as saying Patrick Gray had told him there was no CIA involvement, and he had encouraged Patrick Gray to continue with his investigation. This is the way Patrick Gray remembered it when he testified before the Senate committee.
"Mr. President, there is something I want to speak to you about. Dick Walters and I feel that people on your staff are trying to mortally wound you by using the CIA and FBI and by confusing the question of CIA interest in or not in people the FBI wishes to interview. I have just talked to Clark McGregor and asked him to speak to you about this." There was a slight pause, and the president said, "Pat, you just continue to conduct your aggressive and thorough investigation."
The president, in his written statement, still insisted that Mr. Gray went into more detail than that, telling him that CIA was not involved in the Watergate affair and so forth. But to move on from the address and the written statement itself, we, of course, have some reaction coming in already, and it's mixed. This is the reaction that you might expect from George Bush, the chairman of the Republican National Committee.
"The country wanted to hear from the president. Now they've heard a credible and very reasonable speech. Fair-minded people will find it logical as to what the president did or didn't know. I've traveled extensively across this country recently, and I'm convinced that the American people want us to be about our business as leaders of the free world. They want the country freed from the Watergate obsession, so we can move on the domestic scene as well. In essence, they want Watergate put in its proper perspective. The president's speech, in my view, helped do exactly that."
A critic of the president's stand on withholding those recordings of presidential conversations has been Raoul Berger, professor of American legal history at Harvard. Professor Berger was interviewed tonight by Mitchell Krause.
Professor Berger, tonight Mr. Nixon compared his desire to keep these tapes from reaching the Senate committee and the courts to the lawyer-client relationship. Do you agree with this?
The lawyer-client relationship doesn't rise to the same level. We're talking now about a court that tries to get information in order to do justice to an individual normally. But here we are in the area where Congress, where the Parliament, which has for centuries had legislative oversight, the right of full inquiry for the public welfare. This right seems to me, and in fact it was said so by the Congress 100 years ago, this right transcends the question of individual justice in an individual case. You can't compare justice in an individual case to the importance to the whole nation of finding out the truth about a conspiracy to subvert the electoral process.
So you're saying that regardless of the legality, the president should release the tape?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying more than that. I'm saying I see no constitutional position. I see no constitutional justification. And I want to say to you shortly, first, that there is no constitutional warrants for a claim of a right to withhold anything from the Congress.
So far, we have not yet had any Democratic political reaction. I'm sure that will be coming in shortly. But Bob Thurnberg with CBS radio affiliate WCCO did talk to some people who listened to the president in a restaurant in Minneapolis.
I think the credibility of Nixon is being questioned more than ever. I find it impossible to believe that people are believing him. As an American who's lived outside the United States for an extended length of time and been questioned pointedly about my own president's activities and has been representative of our country, I am not only speechless or wordless as far as being able to explain his actions, but he's just throwing up a smokescreen, and that's hard to explain.
Well, what about the tapes? He said that to give them out, give them to the committee, it would destroy confidentiality needed for future presidents.
Well, I have mixed feelings about that, but I think if I had to comment on my being carried along by my basic feelings and reaction to the speech, I would say that, again, he's throwing up a smokescreen.
Excuse me, so going back to you, if I could, for a minute, you mentioned that you didn't believe the president. What were your thoughts about the president before all of this started? What did you think of Richard Nixon, the man?
I voted for him. I supported him. I worked for him. I did everything I could to help him.
Yay! And now what do you think?
I'm very deeply disturbed. I still trust him, but I think he's been a victim of the political job of being reelected. And his staff went far beyond what would normally be the job of reelecting the president.
I think the dollar will go lower tomorrow in the European market. I think gold will be higher, and I think silver will follow suit. What I'm saying is that there is very little substance to what Richard Nixon said tonight. There is very little which people can hang on to.
Hal Walker and Robert Pierpoint, the presidential speech that was delivered tonight, together with that white paper, happened to come on a day when the Gallup poll showed that only 31% of the people approve of the way the president is handling his job, which is the lowest since the closing month of the Truman administration. Do you think the speech tonight and the statement together will help reverse that verdict?
It's hard to predict how the American people are going to react. If the Republicans and the strong presidential supporters, that is, the Republicans who are strong presidential supporters, are correct, the country is pretty well tired of the Watergate situation. A great many people believe that the president is not telling the whole truth, but they don't care anymore. They want to get on to future business, and that's what he asked them to do tonight. And I have a feeling that the reaction of the country is liable to be, okay, let's forget it and go on.
I can't get over the feeling that that seemed to be the appeal in the closing words of the presidential speech, that he did want to move ahead, let's put Watergate behind us and go on to other matters. And yet I can't help thinking that it would have been interesting to have seen Richard Nixon up there before the Irvin Committee, listening to some of the questions and responding to some of those quotes from the Bible.
The speech and the statement taken together did, as the president in his statement admitted, leave a good many questions unanswered. There was no direct response to many of the John Dean charges.
But, Neil, I would like to point out that we reporters who cover the White House are going to be in the position of questioning the president directly and specifically on these things sometime in the next 2 weeks.
Well, I'll take a quote from Senator Sam Irvin with you, will you?
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Hal Walker and Robert Pierpoint. This has been a CBS News special report, The Watergate, The White House View. I'm Neil Strausser, CBS News, Washington.